From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, protesters outside the court as ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi goes on trial inside. We hear about day one of the legal process against him. Also today, the US tries to mend fences with Saudi Arabia. Did doctors violate the Hippocratic Oath by helping the CIA during the torture of suspected terrorists? The Senate debates legislation aimed at banning workplace discrimination.
We've been fighting for workplace equality actually since 1974. When the Macarena was number one, that's when we last had a vote in the Senate.
And the Berlin street musician and his audience, who were in for a big surprise. That's coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Doctors and nurses monitoring the health of terrorism suspects in U.S. detention have been complicit in torture and abuse, according to a new report. The joint two-year independent study concluded that medical professionals clearly violated the ethical code, which states, first, do no harm. Washington correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
The report says healthcare personnel working for the U.S. Defense Department and the CIA, quote, collaborated in intelligence gathering and security practices in a way that inflicted severe harm on detainees in U.S. custody. The joint study by the Institute of Medicine and the Open Society Foundations also says medical professionals help design, enable, and participate in torture and cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatments of detainees in U.S. prisons in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. The CIA says the report contains serious inaccuracies and erroneous conclusions.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has told Saudi Arabia it's the senior player in the region on a visit aimed at healing tensions in the Middle East. Speaking on a second leg of his 10-day tour of the region, America's top diplomat said Saudi had taken on the main Arab leadership role from restive Egypt. Nina Maria Potts reports from Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says strengthening U.S.-Saudi relations is a top priority for Middle East security and stability. This following an hours-long trip to Cairo, the first unannounced visit by a senior U.S. official because of security reasons amid deepening tensions between the U.S. and Egypt over Washington's cut in aid. The trip to Egypt came just a day before ousted President Mohamed Morsi's trial began and then was deferred by a judge until January. John Kerry's Middle East tour will also take in Jordan, Morocco, and Israel in his latest bid to restore peace to the region.
Thousands of Russian nationalists have demonstrated in Moscow amidst rising tension over migrants. The rally marked Unity Day, a national holiday, with many protesters claiming immigrants are pushing up crime rates and taking jobs. Russia does not require visas for workers from Central Asian republics, so many of the migrants are in the country legally. Our Moscow correspondent Tom Barton has been at the nationalist rally in the Russian capital and says there is a long list of demands.
For things like visa regimes for people in the North Caucasus, even though those people are Russian citizens, there's call for them to have visas to come to places like Moscow. Potentially very explosive issues here. The Moscow mayoral elections showed it as well, with many calls for the deportation of illegal immigrants, potentially a powder keg in Russian society. And these nationalists, a very clear indication of the strong feelings of many Russians towards these migration issues.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. UK Prime Minister David Cameron says support among Britons for remaining in the European Union is wafer thin. David Cameron argues that there needs to be a considerable number of reforms in order to increase support for remaining in the European Union. Our UK correspondent Natalie Feary has more.
David Cameron has said the majority of the British public support his plans regarding European Union membership. He was speaking at the annual conference of the CBI Business Group. The Prime Minister has pledged to renegotiate the UK's relationship with the EU. If his party wins the next election, then a referendum about membership will take place. This comes after the CBI put out a report saying the EU contributes up to 5% of the UK's annual output. Debate is rife among Britain's political parties about membership. Supporters say remaining in the EU is essential for British growth. Some critics say leaving the European Union would mean less bureaucracy and would not mean an end to trading with the region.
And And Canadian smartphone maker BlackBerry has announced that it has abandoned its plans to sell itself to its largest shareholder. The company also announced that Chief Executive Officer Thorstein Hines will step down. From New York, Iris Spitzer has more.
The struggling smartphone maker's attempt to become a private company has collapsed, as their largest shareholder, Fairfax Holdings, will not be purchasing the company, despite their tentative offer to do so in September. That tentative offer had valued the company at $4.7 billion. However, after reporting steep quarterly losses and announcing staff cuts, shares of the company never reached that level. Instead, Fairfax and other unnamed investors will invest $1 billion into the company. The outgoing CEO, Thorstein Hines, had been banking on the new line of BlackBerry 10 handsets to turn the company's fortunes around. However, the BlackBerry 10s never gained any real traction in the smartphone market. Ira Spitzer, New York.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. The noise of angry protesters in Cairo today after the trial of deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi began over his alleged role in the killing of protesters last year. Mr. Morsi used his first public appearance since he was ousted by the military in July to declare his position as the country's head of state and reject the legitimacy of the judicial process that he's facing. Proceedings were adjourned until January. FSN's Kevin McAleese talked to Belle True, a journalist based in Cairo, who witnessed today's events in court.
Well, I was actually in the courtroom there for the opening session of Mr. Morsi's trial, where he's being tried for incitement to kill protesters, clashes that occurred in December last year. And the court hearing was basically adjourned until the 8th of January. This was largely because the court files, the case files, which are several thousand pages long, need to be read and studied properly by the lawyers, who only received the documents quite soon before the hearing took place. So after what was quite a raucous courtroom day, they were basically adjourned it till January, giving the lawyers 3 months to pour over the case files and also for Mr. Morsi's lawyers to actually sit with him, because of course today was the first time he's seen Egypt's former president in 4 months since his ouster. He's been kept in an unknown location incommunicado.
In terms of where this goes next, what will be the next stage in this process?
Well, it's interesting to see what's going to happen. I spoke to lawyers from both sides. This case refers to basically quite bloody clashes that took place outside the presidential palace in December 2012. Mr. Morsi and 14 of his aides are being accused of inciting their supporters to go down and break up a sit-in outside the presidential palace in December. Now, speaking to the lawyers who are representing those victims who are injured or killed outside the presidential palace, they say there is actually grounds for incitement. So although this trial is occurring in a very heavily politicized environment, looking at the evidence, they say there are grounds to accuse some of those people of incitement. So this is not entirely politicized, particularly as the actual trial itself or the accusations were filed in December 2012 before he was ousted. So this isn't something that's just come out of the blue after Mr. Mohamed Morsi was pushed out of office.
Just ahead of the trial, Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Egypt. He wasn't there long. What was he there to do, and how was his visit received?
Well, this is the interesting thing. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, did come for just, I think only a handful of hours to Cairo. Now, this is the highest level visit from the U.S. to Egypt since Mohamed Morsi was ousted by the military on the 3rd of July. The Secretary of State came, I believe, to sort of patch up relations with Egypt. On October the 9th, U.S. officials basically announced that they were going to withhold several hundred million dollars worth of economic assistance to Egypt and also the delivery of helicopters, missiles and fighter jets, as well as tanks, which is part of a kind of economic military package that the U.S. and Egypt have had going back to 1979 peace agreement. So after the U.S. officials stopped that key economic and military aid, or withheld it, to be precise, the relations between U.S. and Egypt soured to quite a considerable extent, to the point where Egypt were essentially accusing the U.S. of trying to interfere in their domestic politics. The U.S. cited, they said the reason they withhold this aid is because they were unhappy with the way that the current interim government was behaving in the military. You know, we've seen hundreds of people die and thousands arrested since Mohamed Morsi was pushed out of office. So John Kerry's visit was quite key because what he was trying to do, I think, was patch up this very important relationship.
Correspondent Belle True on the line earlier today from Cairo. On Capitol Hill, the US Senate has been debating the Employee Non-Discrimination Act today, a bill that would make it illegal to fire someone or discriminate against them in the workplace because of their real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. Though many states and individual companies already have protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender employees, there are no federal anti-discrimination laws like those that exist for race, gender, disability and religion. Though the bill appears likely to pass the Senate this week after a nearly two-decade battle, its fate is uncertain in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. From Capitol Hill, FSN's Alice Olstein reports.
As the U.S. Senate prepared to take a procedural vote Monday on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid urged his colleagues to approve nationwide discrimination protections for LGBT workers, saying the current patchwork of laws isn't good enough. He noted that employees in 29 states can still be fired for being gay, and 34 states allow discrimination against transgender or gender non-conforming workers.
It's time for Congress to pass a federal law that ensures all Americans, regardless of where they live, can go to work unafraid to be who they are. As long as hardworking, qualified Americans can be denied job opportunities, fired or harassed because of their sexual orientation or gender identity, all workers are at risk.
Today's vote marks the 19th time Congress has considered ENDA since it was first introduced in 1994. This time around, all 55 Senate Democrats have declared their support for the bill, and two Republicans have signed on as co-sponsors. Two more Republicans voted for the bill at the committee stage, and a fifth, Nevada Republican Dean Heller, declared his support in a statement Monday morning. Unless someone changes their mind, that gives the bill a 60-vote supermajority that could override a possible filibuster. But ENDA's path to the president's desk became less certain after House Speaker John Boehner announced his opposition to the bill Monday, claiming it would, quote, increase frivolous litigation and cost American jobs. White House spokesperson Jay Carney blasted this position at a press conference Monday.
And his reasoning behind the position he took sounds familiar to the opposition to almost all civil rights measures that have come and been passed into law in this country over the years. That opposition was wrong then, and it's wrong now.
Boehner's announcement comes after months of lobbying against the bill by the Heritage Foundation and other conservative and religious groups. Their main concern is that the bill will infringe on the religious liberty of employers who don't want openly gay or transgender workers. But some LGBT rights advocates, including Heather Kronk with the grassroots organization Get Equal, say the current provisions in the bill for religious employers are already too broad. Unlike the Civil Rights Act and other federal workplace laws, ENDA would give exemptions not only to houses of worship, but to any so-called religiously affiliated entities.
And that can be interpreted in a whole lot of different ways. We're hoping that it would be interpreted narrowly, but it actually opens up the possibility for K-12 schools, for hospitals, for religiously affiliated or historically religious universities. All of those institutions could potentially argue that they should be exempt.
Kronk says she's worried ENDA could even be interpreted to give non-religious employers at regular secular companies the right to discriminate if they claim personal religious opposition to LGBT equality. She cited a ruling by the D.C. Appeals Court just last week that said the Catholic owner of a grocery store could deny his workers health insurance that covers contraception in violation of the Affordable Care Act.
The religious exemptions are a place where this law would actually continue to put LGBT workers into a second-class category.
Get Equal and other LGBT rights groups are pushing senators to attach an amendment to the bill this week that narrows the religious exemption. But other lawmakers have hinted at introducing amendments to broaden the exemption, to allow all schools to discriminate, or to exclude transgender people from the law. Mara Kiesling with the National Center for Transgender Equality said trans workers are already some of the most vulnerable in the country and desperately need better legal protections.
We get calls on most days from people who are facing all sorts of different kinds of discrimination, from just not being able to find a job despite applying for hundreds or thousands of jobs, to people not getting promotions, to people coming out as transgender one day and then being fired the next day.
The first vote on ENDA is scheduled for Monday evening, and the final vote is expected later this week. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now to a new study that suggests doctors working for the US military have actively taken part in the torture of terrorism suspects. The accusations feature in an independent report compiled by medical ethics and military experts. FSN's Priscilla Huff spoke to the co-author of the report, Leonard Rubenstein, and began by asking him about the nature of the alleged abuse.
There were a number of kinds of abuses. One was participation in direct interrogation of detainees. Another was and is a force feeding of detainees using restraint chairs. But the report really goes beyond individual conduct. And what we found was the Department of Defense and the CIA, when it had custody of detainees, changed ethical standards and expectations of the medical personnel they used to authorize and, in fact, direct these kinds of practices, which are contrary to medical ethics.
I was going to say, the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm, and yet they were doing harm.
That's exactly right. That the idea of not harming and taking care of people, that's the doctor's role, that's the health professional's role. And the Department of Defense changed the rules to engage health professionals in security and intelligence functions.
Now, have you had any reaction either from the medical professionals who were involved or more generally from doctors and nurses who are learning about this report?
Well, the medical community generally, the American Medical Association, American College of Physicians, World Medical Association, have repeatedly condemned this kind of conduct. And in fact, they've clarified their rules in the last few years to make it clear that participation in interrogation is inappropriate. We've also had conversations over the last year or two with the Department of Defense and raised our concerns. There have been no changes.
The CIA and the Pentagon have rejected your report, including the CIA public affairs chief saying that your report contains serious inaccuracies and erroneous conclusions. How do you respond to that?
The information the CIA came exclusively about their policies came exclusively from their own documents and Justice Department opinions. Opinions, for example, and documents that say that doctors were involved in approving enhanced interrogation methods, including waterboarding, that doctors were present when waterboarding was used. So we rely on information that they generated.
Leonard Rubenstein talking to FSN's Priscilla Huff.
The Saudis have an ability to be able to influence a lot of the things that we also care about.
Secretary of State John Kerry in Riyadh today.
And we're working together particularly on the Middle East peace process, on Syria, on Egypt, and on Iran.
He declared ties between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are strategic and enduring, despite mounting evidence of enormous strain in the bilateral relationship. FSN's Daniel Wrenches has been speaking with Thomas Lipman of the Middle East Institute in Washington. He's written extensively about America's historic ties with the kingdom. Daniel started by asking him to assess how deep the rift between the two countries runs over Syria.
The Saudis certainly were unhappy with the president's decision to hold off on military strikes against Syria and to pursue the Russian initiative on the chemical weapons. And that comes at a time when there are other things on the agenda that the Saudis are also unhappy about. But it's important to keep in mind that the short-term irritations or unhappiness, however forcefully expressed in public rhetoric, have to be differentiated from the long-term strategic security and economic interests that tie the two countries together. The road is bumpy, but the road is still going in the same direction.
But how significant is the Saudis' apparent move to go independent from the U.S. in terms of military support to the rebels in Syria?
Well, in my view, I would say it's about time if they feel so strongly about it. I mean, up to now, there's been a certain element of, we want to fight in Syria, you do it, we'll hold your coat.
And so Saudi Arabia, could they be the game changer in Syria or just the perpetuator of permanent conflict?
I don't believe the Saudis are able or willing to put sufficient resources in there to bring about a decisive change in the stalemate.
Why?
Why? Partly because they have extremely limited experience in operating outside their own borders. Partly because it's not at all clear whether they could herd the cats of the Syrian opposition to work in harmony. And partly because it's not clear that they would have international support for doing it. I can't identify anybody in the Saudi military leadership who would take on such a mission. I mean, how would they do it?
John Kerry talked in his remarks to his own staff in Riyadh about Saudi Arabia becoming the big player in the region, the responsible player, given that Egypt is in such turmoil. Do you think they are able and willing to play that role?
This, from the Saudi perspective, this is all about Iran. They view themselves as locked in a kind of permanent conflict with Iran for supremacy in Islam and supremacy in the Gulf. They're very apprehensive about the Iranian nuclear program. So all their tactical moves have to be evaluated through that prism.
Isn't it slightly ridiculous then to say that the Saudis can be the great stabilizing role in the region, given that they have a very strong underlying policy dominated by this desire to compete with Iran?
Well, ridiculous may be too strong a word, but it's really not practical. Because, among other things, the small sheikhdoms that are Saudi Arabia's partners in the Gulf Cooperation Council, which are also military partners of the United States, are, what should we say, they're very suspicious of Saudi Arabia's motives and intentions. So if the Saudis certainly can't face down the Iranians on their own. They just don't have the organizational capability, the depth of the officer corps, the size of the population, or for that matter, the kind of militant commitment to take on these ventures outside their borders.
Journalist Thomas Lipman talking to FSN's Daniel Wrenches. We go now to the Greek capital, Athens, where a slew of new radio stations have taken to the airwaves over the last few years, challenging the country's mainstream media. It has been severely hit by the twin threats of the country's economic crisis and its meddling politicians. Radio Bubble is an online radio station with a massive following, funded by a cafe in downtown Athens of the same name. Its founders say they wanted to challenge the mainstream media, almost all of which is controlled by the Greek business elite or by the state, with both attempting to dictate the editorial line. FSN's Nina Maria Potts spoke to Radio Bubble's producer, Vasilis, and he told her how the station got going.
Radio Bubble started almost 6 years ago. 2011 was the peak of Radio Bubble when the demonstrations in downtown Athens at Syntagma Square outside the Greek Parliament gave the opportunity to the people to come together from their digital life to the real life. And that's when I met with the guys at Radio Bubble.
How do you see your political message, if you like, having evolved over the last couple of years?
As about mainstream media in Greece, there's a huge gap between the real story, the underreported news, and the story that we see through our televisions or read in newspapers. And citizen journalism job is to fill that gap in order to promote any news that we are not going to see in our TVs and to investigate some issues that no mainstream media would like to touch or to search into it. And that's the reason that citizen journalism was started back in 2010 or 11, I would say, because that's when the financial crisis here in Greece started.
And do you see the problems that ERT, Greece's national broadcaster, has run into, the financial problems of Greece? I mean, is the reality that the truth now can only be told through radio stations like yours?
Radio Bubble tried to promote and mostly to help the journalists and all the other employees in ERT. Along with other independent media, like the Press Project, for example, and to show how to use the social media in order to organize, to promote their views through the Internet. And the Internet used to be an unknown place for most of the mainstream old, not by age, but by their way of thinking journalists. And now, after more than 150 days, we show that there are millions of Greeks that are watching ERT through the Internet. And that's something that creates a new culture, I'd say, on how Greeks searching and trying to find out new ways of information. And one of them is Radio Bubble, that's for sure.
The reality that you're describing is pretty dark and pretty bleak in terms of the persecution of journalists and the media. And, I mean, how worried or concerned are you that this now represents the future of press freedom in Greece?
Greece is placed 27th on the developed countries according to the freedom of journalism. The whole state, I would say, or the whole system, that's correct, deals with everyone that is trying to investigate into some scandals that no mainstream media would like to talk about.
Radio Bubble producer Vasilis on the line from Athens. He was talking to FSN's Nina Maria Potts. And finally tonight, there are lots of other news programmes where you could have caught up today on all the action at last night's YouTube Music Awards. This is not one of them. But we did find something on YouTube today that we thought you might like to hear.
But the answers you seek will never be found at all.
It was filmed over the weekend in Berlin, where a street musician was performing Bronski Beat's 1984 hit, Small Town Boy.
Turn away, turn away, run away, turn away, run away.
And then he's joined by a man out walking his dog.
Run away, turn away.
Oh, wait. One, two, three, run away, turn away, run away, turn away, run away.
That man, none other than Bronski Beat's lead singer, Jimmy Somerville.
Run away, turn away, run away. Run away, turn away, turn away, turn away, run away. Run away, turn away, run away, turn away, run away.
Into your soul.
Very nice.
Well done.
Is it you?
It's a hat. It's me.
Oh my God.
It's me.
It is magical stuff. If you'd like to see it, we have tweeted out a link to that video. Just hop on to our Twitter feed. You can find us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that is the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Tomorrow, in uncertain economic times, the canny investors putting their money in to Scotch whiskey. That's tomorrow. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside producer Kevin McAleese and Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.